All right, good morning. Happy Tuesday. I call the meeting of the Capital Investment Committee today, Tuesday, February 18th, 2025, to order. And do I have a motion from Representative Reimer to adopt the minutes of last week?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved.
Great. That was February 13th meeting minutes. Great. Thank you, Representative Reimer. And there is a quorum present, so that's awesome. Now, we have a jam-packed agenda today, so we're going to get going with some more presentations from the governor's bonding request. First up, we have the Department of Veteran Affairs. So if you are here, please make your way to the front. State your name for the record and proceed with your exciting testimony.
Good morning, Chair Franson and members. For the record, my name is John Kelly, and I serve as the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Governor's 2025 capital budget recommendations for the department. As we get going in this presentation, the returning members of the committee will notice that the requests from the department may look familiar. That is because they are the same requests as last session with slightly different dollar amounts. This slide shows the mission of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We are proud to serve Minnesota's veterans, their dependents, and survivors by connecting them with the federal and state care and benefits they have earned. To accomplish this mission, we run the state veterans' homes and assist the state's nearly 300,000 veterans and their dependents in securing available benefits and services. This slide shows our locations statewide. Thanks to the leadership and partnership of the legislature, Minnesota now has 8 veterans' homes and 4 state veteran cemeteries across the state. The offices of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs are primarily in the Veterans Service Building in St. Paul, the Henry Whipple Federal Building in Bloomington, and the Fargo, North Dakota Claims Office, as a large portion of Western Minnesota is served by the Fargo VA Health System. This slide provides an overview of the department's approach to asset preservation, prioritization, and spending. Our asset preservation projects are based on significant analysis that focuses on critical life safety and programmatic needs across our footprint. As you can see from this slide, we have 71 buildings across the state with a replacement value of $500 million. 12 of these buildings are part of our state veterans' homes and have a 24/7 occupancy. The renovations and upgrades made with asset preservation dollars ensure our 900-plus residents are in facilities that are in good condition. Many of our state veterans' homes have recently been ranked by U.S. News & World Report as some of the best nursing homes in the country. And asset preservation dollars will go a long way towards helping us maintain the quality of care for our residents. This next slide shows the first 2025 governor's capital budget recommendation, which is for asset preservation funding for MDVA. The $11.94 million in asset preservation funds will go towards deferred maintenance in our homes and cemeteries. This asset preservation number reflects a slightly scaled down version of the 2024 recommendation. It's scaled down because the overall size of the governor's capital budget bill has been scaled down due to guideline 3 of the state's debt capacity limit. This slide shows examples of projects in our asset preservation request. These projects include roofs, boilers, mechanical and electrical replacements, and other critical repairs. Specific examples from our asset preservation list include $158,000 at Minneapolis Home for plaster work to $1.5 million in our Silver Bay Home for plumbing systems and fixtures for single-use bathrooms, which is a priority from a health and safety standpoint, as well as a strong preference from our residents. As you can see from this slide, this request is intended to address the backlog of our highest priority asset preservation needs. Much of this funding would target historic structures still in daily use at our Minneapolis campus. Some of these buildings are more than 100 years old. This is our next governor's capital budget recommendation for MDVA, which is $17.404 million for the Minneapolis Veterans Home Building 16 remodel. Building 16 is a domiciliary program resident building that is occupied 24/7. Pre-design work had been started with some existing funds and then was paused, and this new funding would enable the agency to move to the next stages of design and complete the remodel of the space for our residents. The HVAC system in Building 16 has periodic failures, and through the discovery process and pre-design, it was determined that many other building systems are past their useful lives and need replacement. The remodel of Building 16 will ensure that MDVA meets state and federal building codes, life safety codes, Department of Health surveys, and it will enable MDVA to provide a safe environment for vulnerable adults. With this funding for Building 16, Minnesota could in the next few years complete a cycle of major project-related investments in its veterans that would be truly historic. This would be the next major project in a series of projects from bonding bills that have funded the completion of 3 new veterans' homes, 1 new veterans' cemetery, and funded the state portion of the renovation and remodel of the other MDVA domiciliary facility in Hastings. Thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee this morning, and I will now stop and stand for questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Members, do we have any questions for the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota?
Sexton.
What? All right. Representative Sexton, you're on deck.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Kelly, how old is Building 16 and how many occupants?
Madam Chair, Representative, Building 16
Kelly.
Was built in 1973 and it houses 50 occupants. The HVAC system in Building 16 is original to when it was built and passed its useful life, and there's a lot of other issues there as well.
Mr. Sexton, Representative Sexton.
Thank you, ma'am.
Lead Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director Kelly. So I'm just curious, you know, have any of the federal funding pauses impacted our veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota, and how would that impact any capital needs or operation needs, if you could share with us? Thank you.
Mr. Kelly?
Chair, Representative, so the Department of Veterans Affairs, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, gave probably one of the most unequivocal "you're okay" kind of messages that the federal government has given so far. So there are 44 distinct federal grant programs from USDVA, and the acting secretary at the time said that none of those were impacted either by the Office of Management and Budget memo or the other president's executive order. So right now, you know, the per diems that help fund our resident care are flowing, and we are still waiting for reimbursement for the last portions of the new home, the 3 new homes, but we have not gotten any indication that that funding is paused or on hold. We're just in the pipeline.
Leadley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last follow-up, Director Kelly. I understand that, you know, for new veterans home or whatnot, there's federal funds tied to that. And so Building 16, since this is just a renovation or whatnot, there's not federal funds tied to this then. Is that correct?
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. So for this project, we're simply asking for the straight bonding request to cover the cost. We're not seeking matching funds from the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Do we have any other member questions? All right, seeing none, thank you for your time. Thank you for visiting today, Mr. Kelly. Next up, we have MnDOT, everybody's favorite organization here. If you want to make your way to the front, thank you. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Taylor Besser-Frederick, Assistant Budget Director with MnDOT.
And I'm Eric Rudine, MnDOT Government Affairs.
Thank you for having us today to discuss the Governor's capital budget recommendations for MnDOT. A little bit of level setting, the transportation system in Minnesota is quite big. So we have the 4th largest roadway system in the country, which spans over 143,000 center lane miles. MnDOT supports 3 active Lake Superior ports and 4 Mississippi River port systems. We address 34 transit providers that cover all 80 non-metro counties in Minnesota. There are 133 publicly funded state airports in our transportation system and over 4,500 rail line miles serving 21 rail companies in Minnesota. We have two recommendations included in the governor's capital budget requests. The first is for highway railroad crossing warning devices. These are the signal arms that come down that signal when it is safe or not safe for cars to cross over railroad track. The reliability of these gates is critical for public safety, as you can imagine. If you think those are unreliable lights and arms dropping when it's time to cross or not cross railroad tracks, that can cause folks to unsafely drive over rail. We have $1.8 million in geo bonds included in the governor's recommendation for this capital request, and we have about 750 signal systems that are out of life cycle. Total cost to replace those is over $300 million, but that's not what MnDOT is seeking here. We couldn't replace them all at once annually. So continued ongoing bonding funding to keep those signals in life cycle is what this request is for. And we did receive $3.6 million in GO bonds in 2023 for this project. The second request we have in the governor's recommendations is for the Port Development Assistance Program. So that's $2.8 million of GO bonds to support infrastructure needs on those public ports. We did receive funds for this in 2023 as well, where we received $1.8 million of GO bonds. This is in partnership with the Ports Development Assistance Program, which determines needs for those public ports. Anyway, I want to acknowledge that MnDOT received quite a bit of capital funding in 2023. So just a brief overview of what we received was more than $400 million in the capital investment bill and then additional funds in the omnibus transportation bill as well. Many of these funding ongoing needs for transportation in Minnesota.
All right, so that was a pretty speedy testimony there. Love it. We up for questions, we have Representative Scraba, and he doesn't really speak much in this committee, so I'm excited to hear what he has to say. Go ahead, Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Assistant Budget Director Frederick, on the railroad crossing, what responsibility does the railroad company have for these crossings, and what is our responsibility?
Ms. Frederick?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your question. I'm going to punt to my colleague, Eric Rudine, on this one.
Mr. Rudine?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scraba. So we do coordinate with railroads on these projects. Typically, the road authority is responsible for the installation of the signals and things, and then the railroad is the entity that actually operates them, and so that's their cost participation. And so, you know, these devices do wear out over time and need to be replaced, and so that's what this request would help us with.
Representative Scraba.
Madam Chair, so we pay for them, they maintain them, and operate them?
Madam Chair and Representative Scraba, yes, that's correct.
All right, thank you. Madam Chair, I have another question. On the Port Development Assistance Program, $2.8 million for infrastructure, which ports on Great Lakes are getting the funding?
Who would like to take that? All right, Mr. Rudine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The five public ports in Minnesota that are eligible for this program are St. Paul, Duluth, Red Wing, Wabasha, and Winona. There have been a couple instances where we've used some funds for this program for privately owned ports. So if there's, for example, dredging that's required, or, you know, it has to be public sort of infrastructure. It cannot be used, since their bond funds cannot be used for privately owned infrastructure.
Madam Chair,
Representative Scraba.
Yeah, the only reason I bring in the overview, you have three active Lake Superior and four Mississippi River. I was wondering what the three on Lake Superior, if they're all in the Port of Duluth, or if I know Silver Bay had one and Two Harbors has one, but are they funded by this?
Mr. Rudine?
Madam Chair, they would not be funded because they're private facilities. The other ones outside of Duluth. Again, if there was some component of a public infrastructure associated with them, I think the dredging I referred to is really more like I'm thinking of the cargo port on the Minnesota River. you know, typically you're not doing a lot of dredging in Lake Superior. So I don't think they would be, you know, that's not to say, though, if they didn't have a project that, that could be publicly financed, they, you know, we could participate in that program if there was such a project.
Representative Scraba.
Nope. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's it. Thanks.
All right. Representative Kosnick.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. I just wanted to clarify on slide four. You had previous appropriations for the Port Development Assistance Program. I thought I heard you say 1.8 million. The slide that we have says 18.1 million. Can you clarify for the 2023 GEO bonds appropriated?
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, yes, 18.1 million. My apologies if I misspoke.
Okay, thank you. Just so the slide is correct, and it is 18.1. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you for answering that, Ms. Frederick. Next up, we have Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had a discussion about the Washington Avenue Bridge and trying to repair that in Minneapolis for suicide prevention along the University of Minnesota. Could you give us an update on what's happening with the Washington Avenue Bridge?
Ms. Frederick or Mr. Radin?
Yes. Thanks, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. So that is a Hennepin County bridge, and they did install, in partnership with the university, some temporary fencing. They're still looking for a more permanent solution in that location. So the bridge would be eligible for the local bridge replacement and rehabilitation program. However, the type of fencing that they're looking for, I don't think is something that typically has been funded through that program. So I think the county and the university are still looking for some, as I said, more permanent solution there. And MnDOT has provided some technical assistance there. You know, we've had other bridges where this has been an issue, and so we've provided some input as they're thinking about a more permanent solution. We will continue to do that.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and, is this something where we need ongoing funding just to modify bridges where there's a likelihood of suicide, you know, that rather than taking one at a time, is this something that could be done either with setting up a sub-account under trunk highway bonds, or do we put bonding, geo-bonding in it, or something that is needed to kind of proof the, you know, driving across the high bridge here, you see the protections that have been made and it stops. It stops the suicides. So prevention can be very valuable for families and for our state. And just as the department looked at that, is there something we could do for, so it's not just this particular site, but others in the future?
Who would like to take that? All right, Mr. Radin. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. Yeah, I don't know that we've really given consideration to establishing a program, but I could see there would potentially be some value there, and we can certainly go back and talk to our bridge office about that. You know, there have been, let me say that when we do a bridge replacement or a major bridge project, we always take that into consideration, but there are times where you might want to act more quickly than waiting, you know, if a bridge isn't due for major rehab for 20 years and you've got an issue, you know, you really need to get out there more quickly and address that. So there have been a couple instances where we've had trunk highway bridges where we've had to make some adjustments, you know, until such time as we can do a larger project. So we can have some discussion about that, certainly.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if we have to, we're only in session from January to May. If there are emergency needs that pop up, I would think having an account that could be there to respond when we're not there. I'm not talking a huge amount of money, but something that maybe we can respond or react if we set something up. So I'd appreciate if the department, I realize that it's a county bridge, but, you know, there may be a public benefit for the whole state there on assisting if the locals cannot.
Thank you. Mr. Rudin, the Tom Rukavina Memorial Bridge, is it something that a similar concept, could that be applied to the Washington Bridge?
Madam Chair, yeah, I think that's something we could look at. You know, they're both bridges that are very high up, and those tend to be those, and sometimes, you know, bridges over busy roads, even if they're not very high up, are the types of bridges that we have to be concerned about. So, you know, the fencing, it actually can weigh quite a lot, you know, the sort of the permanent iron fencing. And so to just retrofit that to some of the older bridges is maybe not always possible without doing some sort of a project to strengthen the bridge so that it can handle the additional weight. But in that case, you know, that was a brand new bridge, and so we're able to just incorporate that as with the new high bridge into the design.
Thank you for that. Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair, and, so I'm a big fan of Stay Across the School, and I can't find it in the proposal for this year. You know, it just seems like in 23 we did $2.4 million, but I can't quite find it for what's in the proposal for this year. And maybe
who would like to take that one? All right, Ms. Frederick.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, thank you. The Safe Routes to School program is not currently included in the governor's capital budget recommendations for 2025, but this is a program that MnDOT has historically funded with bonds and received substantive funding in the last bonding for 2023.
All right, thank you. First off, we have Lee up, unless you want to. Okay, thank you. Representative Scraba, enlighten us. Thank you, Representative Scraba. That could have been considered an offline conversation. Lead Lee.
Hand it over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe if Representative Scraba and Representative Lilly wants to sign on to the bill that we both co-authored, then they could do so too. And it's already been dropped. So just going to the presentation, thank you for coming by. So similar to my questions to the Veterans Affairs Department, have you received any notice on any potential federal freeze to any of the programs or funding that you received from the federal government?
Mr. Rodine?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lee. Yes, we've heard about a few programs so far. So the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure, or NEVI, program, we've already received notice on that. The PROTECT program, which is a resiliency program, they had a notice of funding opportunity posted on the USDOT website that has been pulled down. And so we haven't really received official word on that, but we anticipate that is a program that they will be targeting for funding pause or suspension. Not quite sure the exact term because we haven't gotten official guidance yet on that. And then the carbon reduction program is the other program that we've heard will be targeted. But it's really the NEVI program we've gotten the most guidance on so far. And as of today, and this does change frequently, it seems, but as of today, the NEVI formula funds have continued to flow that have been obligated. It's really funds that have not yet been obligated. So there's about $4 million of NEVI funds that we were anticipating to receive that we are now not expecting to receive.
Lead Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. And then just switching gears a little bit, tying to some of the work that we do in our committee here, I know that a few communities across the state have been awarded some transportation, awards. You know, for example, the city of Minneapolis with the Minneapolis Nicollet Bridge, I believe, was awarded $34 million, and then the city of Duluth for the Aerolift Bridge was around $11.2 million. Do you know, or to what extent do you know, are these impacted by any of the federal freezes or not? Because I think that, you know, Madam Chair, it ties into some of the work that we're doing, you know, at least for the city of Minneapolis. You know, if they do receive the $34 million, then their request to the state will only be $2 million. But if they don't have the federal funds, then it will be a pretty big ask.
Mr. Rudin?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Lee, so far, we've not heard that any of those projects are in jeopardy, but we also have sort of heard that, you know, if you have funds that are not obligated or spent, really, like, everything's sort of on the table at this point, and they're reviewing all IIJA programs, the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. So, you know, we have our own concerns with the Blatnik Bridge in Duluth, which we received a $1 billion grant for with the state of Wisconsin. That's a significant dollar amount, obviously, and we really couldn't construct that project without the federal grant. So, you know, we've been in communication with members of Congress, and they've assured us that those sort of traditional road and bridge projects should be okay. But, you know, as I said earlier, it kind of changes day to day, and it seems like, you know, somebody said last week, if you think your funding is in jeopardy in the morning, just wait until afternoon, and then you might get worried that you're okay. So we're continuing to monitor the situation, and we'll certainly let you know if we hear of any attempts to claw back that type of funding.
Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a last follow-up. Maybe this might be a little bit two-part question for both MnDOT, and I see that MNB is on here too. So on page 5 of the presentation, you mentioned the funding that was included in the transportation bill from 2023. Am I correct that some of these funding, especially for trunk highway bonds, were authorized for future years? And if so, can you share how these future authorization impact our state's overall debt capacity, you know, borrowing, and some of the internal guidelines that, you know, the state, whether that's through MNB or the MnDOT, have for our ability to do our work here in this committee?
Who would like to take that question?
Madam Chair, I'll just maybe say that we do have an internal trunk highway guideline for debt, which is no more than 20% of state revenues of the trunk highway fund should be used for debt service. We do have some capacity there for additional trunk highway bonds, but as far as how that interacts with the overall state borrowing capacity, I would defer to MMB on that one.
Sorry, Leadley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And MMB is here too, so I'd like to hear from them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. If you want to come on up front to the front, state your name for the record, and go ahead and answer. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Convoy, and I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget. So just for a little bit of background, MMB's capital investment guidelines were first established in 1979, and Guideline 3 has been a measure of those guidelines since 1982. The first two guidelines that we have as a state measure existing authorized debt against personal income, and the third measures how quickly the state pays down the debt. And so that Guideline 3 is that 40% of general obligation bonds shall be due within 5 years, and 70% are due within 10 years, if consistent with the useful life of the financed assets and or market conditions. And so ultimately what that means for the governor's recommendations, trunk highway bonds impact Guideline 3. The governor's recommendations include cash, and so it's not bonding and it's not hitting against Guideline 3 like the GO bonds do. And again, trunk highway bonds are authorized in the Constitution, and they have the full faith and credit because it's a type of GO bond. And so that's kind of how the interaction of the governor's recommendations lie with Guideline 3.
Thank you, Ms. Conway. Leadley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for indulging in the follow-up question. So maybe to Mr. Andy Lee from House Fiscal, then, since we didn't get an answer from the agency, can you tell us from the 2023 appropriations of the $600 million or so, how much of that was authorized for future years, And I think the question is, you know, for those future authorization, how is that impacting our ability right now to bond for more than $790 million?
And who would like to take that question? Okay, it's going to take a little bit. All right. Are we just going to chill here until we have an answer then? All right, we'll jump to then. No, we have Representative Perez Vega next.
Kind of scrambling over here. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question in regards, I know that the Robert Treat Viaduct in my district received federal approval of grants for January 2025 of $25 million. That project's not going to start till 2028, is that correct?
Mr. Rudin.
Madam Chair, yes, that's my understanding, and that kind of gets to our earlier conversation of if you don't have those federal funds sort of obligated, which we do not for that project. Those are, you know, I would say still grants that we're concerned about. There is a large flurry of announcements shortly before President Biden left office, including that Robert Street Viaduct. And so, you know, we haven't received word yet that they're trying to put those funds on pause, but certainly anything that we don't have a signed grant agreement for, which would include all those grant announcements that came on, around January 20th, yeah, we would be concerned and certainly monitoring to hopefully, you know, see if the Federal Highway Administration will continue the process of getting a grant and grant agreement in place with us.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick follow-up on that. You know, I have several constituents that live between King Street and the Cesar Chavez Street that it crosses on that viaduct that have been extremely concerned and occupying my inbox and community town hall forums regarding the work of what's happening in an emergency crisis when the viaduct is crumbling. I'm receiving reports from the city. What are the initiatives that MDOT are doing to, not so to say Band-Aid work or patch it up, but that are taking this note seriously? When we think about, you know, 2008 bridges falling apart, families losing members, these are things that have not been worked on an infrastructure that's over 100 years old.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Perez Vega. Yes, we are continuing to monitor the condition of the viaduct and have annual inspections to make sure that the viaduct is safe and as well as the bridge that crosses over the viaduct. So we will continue to do that and continue to work on developing a full replacement project for that facility. You know, if the federal funding doesn't come through, then we're really going to have to explore other ways to come up with that funding because it is a significant cost. I think it was, I remember, I think the grant was around $38 million for that project. So it's a significant dollar amount.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, in regards to following that up, is there continued communication that's happening within the community organizations, such as Westside Community Organizations? Are they being updated? Because I had requested to have a follow-up from MDOT from our following meeting that we held about 3 months ago directly with my offices, and I have yet to receive the data regarding the questions that I had. And we can take this off the record as well, but these are some inputs and questions as to how they're being administered and when the funds do arrive that the community is being updated, especially my offices. Thank you.
Mr. Rudin, did you want to address that?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, we will follow up with our metro district and make sure to get you that information.
Thank you. No further questions, Madam Chair.
Mr. Rudin, I do have a question. The train to Duluth, are we at risk of losing federal funding there?
Madam Chair.
I would be devastated.
Yes, Madam Chair, we submitted a what's called a federal state partnership program grant request in December. Those grants were not announced before President Biden left office. And, you know, we've been told probably spring, so, you know, any time March to May potentially is when we could find out whether we will receive any funding for the Northern Lights Express
Okay. Thank you for answering my question. We have Representative Kosnick, and then we have Representative Scraba, and then if there are no further member questions, then we will go to the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Mr. Radin, continuing the conversation on federal funds. Oh, you were recently in D.C. and spoke to our federal legislative delegation. Did you have any conversation, or can you share with the committee what would the North Star Commuter Rail gave us a federal grant? Have you had any conversations on what it would cost to terminate that federal grant, or what is the process to get a waiver if that was service was eliminated, saving the state about $10 or $11 million?
Mr. Rudin.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, we have had some, I don't know that we've had specific conversations about closing the service. More about, you know, potentially extending the service. Now we are working on a legislative report that is due, and I hope will be delivered by the end of this week, that will outline the process with the Federal Transit Administration in this case to potentially terminate that service, as well as the payback to the federal government, because they participated in the original construction of the project, and so they still have a federal interest that would need to be paid back, and so we're attempting to estimate those costs. It will be a range. We can't give you a, you know, specific dollar amount until we've had that conversation with the Federal Transit Administration. The Met Council was actually the operator of the service, as you know, so they would really be the ones that would have the discussion with the FTA and try to get a specific number, but that will also take several months, is my understanding, for them to, you know, provide that that direction to us. So that will be sort of outlined in the report too, is, you know, here's the process that you would need to go through.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments. And just to share with the committee, you know, if there's concern about federal funds, extending that commuter rail would cost a significant amount of money. So I wouldn't anticipate that there are additional federal dollars to do that. And, of course, the ridership would need to be there that it hasn't been. So I look forward to reading the report and exploring the opportunity to cease that and terminate that line.
All right. Thank you for those questions, Representative Kosnick. Thank you, Mr. Rudin. Before we pivot to Representative Scraba with some more words of wisdom, we're going to jump to Mr. Andrew Lee, if you want to present your answer.
Madam Chair and members, and Lead Lee, so to the question about the debt management guidelines, specifically the third debt capacity and trunk highway bonds that were authorized in prior legislative sessions, there is outstanding from prior trunk highway bond authorizations from 2024, $19 million, from 2023, $565 million, from 2021, $348 million, from 2020, $62 million, from 2018, $237.2 million. Those are the larger amounts and still outstanding trunk highway bond authorization that has not yet been sold. So MMB needs to assume those will be sold in the coming years, and that is one of the factors that is constraining the state's debt capacity vis-a-vis guideline number three.
Okay, thank you. That is a good question. Thank you for that. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a whole lot of money. It's a lot of money, almost a billion, if not more than a billion. I have a question for Mr. Rudin. Some of the questions this morning have been referring to federal aid, and on January 20th, when President Biden kind of threw out a whole bunch of projects saying, we're going to fund these, did the state have any matching dollars for them? Was it part of a system? When you were answering, I was kind of getting a feel that we don't have any matching money for this right now, but we anticipate it, but we don't have it now. And then the feds just go ahead and throw out a bunch of money for us, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, kind of like a Hail Mary. Maybe we'll, some of this will stick, some of it won't, because some of these projects, if not all of them, are very worthy. They just have to go through the process. And I was just wondering if this was trying to circumvent the process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So the legislature in 2023 appropriated about $200 million in general funds to match federal grants. We have been committing those dollars, and we anticipate needing about $40 million in matching funds for the grants that were announced on January 20th. We only have about $20 million left, though, so there's already going to be about a $20 million shortfall if all of those grants, you know, are actually obligated eventually. So we have yet to sort of determine how to disperse those funds. You know, should we sort of hold them and wait to see if they get a grant agreement in place and then award them? We had been doing it as a first come, first served. You know, once somebody applied for the local match funds, then we sort of, you know, notified them that those funds would be there. But now with this shortfall, I think, you know, we'll need to take a look to determine if there's some other process. As people were applying, they could refer to the state matching funds as their local match, but they also needed to commit, you know, other resources to be able to receive those federal funds if the state matching funds weren't there. So that would be whoever the award recipient is, you know, whether it was MnDOT or a city or a county or whomever applied.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scrabble.
So someone could have, the federal government could have given money to a project that did not have the matching dollars?
Mr. Rudin?
Madam Chair, no, I think the federal government sort of requires you to say, yes, the local match will be there. The logistics of, you know, how much of it is state funds versus city funds, for example, I think that's something that can be sort of worked out after you get the grant announcement.
So,
Representative Scrabble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So part of my concern, my thoughts are, if a project made it through the scrutiny to get to the federal level to ask for, and I'll use Representative Perez Vega's $25 million project, and it made it through the system, and it asking for a match, and the federal government said, yep, we're going to match it. We have the match on our side to match it. So why would that project even be in peril with the federal government, even though they're saying they're cutting it, but you're, the inside people are saying, if you have a match and the federal government said they were going to match it, that should be pretty safe.
Mr. Rudin.
Am I going down the right rabbit hole?
That's a good question, actually. So, Madam Chair, if you do not have, so there's kind of a process. There's the grant announcement. So you're just, you know, the USDOT sends out a press release and says, hey, you're going to get this money. But then you actually have to go through a process to have a signed grant agreement in place, and that's really what obligates the federal government to send you those dollars. Now, even after you get a grant agreement in place, there's obligating funds within what's called FEMIS, which is the federal accounting system for transportation dollars. And so once you've obligated the funds in FEMIS, then like you're really guaranteed to get those funds. So, you know, projects can be in different phases there. And, you know, so far we feel that if you have a signed grant agreement in place, you're pretty likely to get those funds. But again, with all these projects that were just announced on January 20th, none of them have a signed grant agreement in place yet.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Well, thanks for your testimony. Thanks for coming in front of our committee today. We appreciate it. And thanks for taking the question, Mr. Andrew Lee. All right. So next up, we have the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. If you want to make your way to the testimony table on this Tuesday morning, And state your name for the record, and then you may proceed. Members will take questions again at the end of their testimony. So get them ready, Representative Scraba.
I'm ready.
We all just love poking at you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission.
My name is Neil Ladd. I'm the Executive or Deputy Executive Director for the National Sports Center.
Madam Chair, members, I did send along a presentation, but if we just walk through the handout, that's fine. I don't think we need to project anything. You're good? Great. Well, most of you know the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission is a real jewel and gem for the state of Minnesota. Our primary task, statutorily task, is to provide economic impact through sports tourism. And we like to say we do that in spades. Over the life of the facility, we've created over $1 billion in economic impact based on sports tourism for the state of Minnesota. Each year, depending as we climb back from the shutdown during COVID, we project our economic impact to be about $90 million a year through the events that we hold and host up at the National Sports Center. Just real quickly, wanted to make sure that you understood the facility. There might be some new members. Most of you have either been there to see grandchildren play or to see your children play, but you understand it's a 700-acre campus. We have 8 sheets of ice. We have over 60 soccer fields. We're in the Guinness Book of Records as the largest soccer facility in the world. We're very excited about the work that we do for that campus. It's one of our primary roles as the Amateur Sports Commission. There are only 2 employees at the commission, but is to ensure the management and the running of that facility. My colleague Nia Ladd is going to walk through a little bit of the, we use the state of Minnesota's Department of Administration's Facilities Assessment Report to rate our 23 buildings and to talk about the condition that they are in, meet with MMB and walk through what that report says, and come up with our bonding request based on those numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Currently, the National Sports Center's replacement value is just over $205 million. And if you think about that in terms of what has the state invested versus what it's worth right now, I think the state's put in roughly about $40 to $45 million. Currently, its replacement value, like I said, is $205 million. On that state asset, $78 million is in the deferred maintenance category in that FCA report. And if we focus specifically on the super rink, which is, like Todd mentioned, one of the largest ice arenas in the country, it has $66 million replacement value and about $40 million in deferred maintenance currently. We're one of the highest state agencies that has a deferred maintenance number that is in that crisis category. The back 4 sheets of the 8 is roughly about $18.2 million in the poor category of deferred maintenance. Currently, what we are asking for in our asset preservation dollars in the original request from the Amateur Sports Commission was $23.35 million, and that would go for an R22 changeout. Currently, we are on the old refrigerant, and that is no longer available for us to purchase. So we will be switching out from R22 to an ammonia system. Newer technology, we feel like it is proven and tested in ice arenas throughout the state of Minnesota, and we feel like moving forward with that would provide an environment for another 30-year run with a facility that's owned by the state.
So Madam Chair, members, it's really two...
I want to state your name for the record again so we know.
My name, Todd. This is Todd Johnson, the Executive Director of the Sports Center. Just wanted to make sure people understand the level of use that this facility gets. So we are the second largest tourist attraction in the state of Minnesota with about 4 million visitors. Half of those people, if you roughly break it in half to make it simple, use the ice facility, and the other half are there for our soccer events. It's we've done everything we can, and thank goodness there's an there's a fund of money through the Department of Administration called CAPRA, which is there for emergency funds, which we've used. We just had a compressor blow up after 30 years of use and regular maintenance, but they do have a shelf life, and we're just at that point right now with this facility. My impression I want to leave with you is for you to understand that this is a statewide asset. It's not just an asset for that region of the state of Minnesota. Almost every county, every legislative, every house district has been represented there with athletes, either at our biggest event, which is USA Cup. Last year we had a record of 1,200 teams from 19 countries and 29 different states that attended that event last year. That event alone is about $34 million in economic impact. Similarly, and when there are days like yesterday when schools are closed, I wandered over to our ice rink, and you could barely literally get to sort of hop around all of the children that were there playing in a 3-on-3 tournament in all 8 sheets of ice. I looked at the board. I assumed that these were mostly Minnesota teams. I asked the director of the rink. There were teams there from Kansas City. There were a team from Ohio. There was a team from Colorado. But for the most part, it's the citizens of the state who use this facility. We like to brag and talk about the number of outside visitors, because that's what we're charged to do, is to provide economic impact through sports tourism. We do that. We believe like no other entity. We're talking to a group right now about another 600 team tournament that would take place. MLS has been talking to us about that event. That's a soccer event, but there are only 2 weekends of the year that this ice rink is not used. It is a full-time endeavor to run this facility. Many of you have been up to visit it and see it and understand that we are at a position where we really need to figure out what we're going to do if we don't get the dollars to replace the refrigerant and to move forward. Specifically, one of the things that we want to do, and we've talked to USA Hockey about, I've talked to Representative Emmer about it, others who understand it, is we are kind of home now, but we want to be even a bigger home for sled hockey and for those athletes who play sports in an adaptive manner. There's a way that we can make our facility the premier place in the country to do that, and that's, some of you may remember, the old St. Paul Civic Center had all glass boards. If you think about a young girl who goes up on her sled and their team's supposed to play next, well, you can't be like the other 12-year-old girls and see through without having that sort of glass board. Similarly, you make an adjustments for the egress out of the player box and the penalty box, and we have plans to be able to do that, to make sure that this is the most adaptive facility in the nation for those type of events. That's both children who play sled hockey and the Wounded Warriors group, the Defending the Blue Line group has some folks who do that, the Hendrickson Foundation and others, and we're very proud of that aspect that we provide for the state of Minnesota.
I have a question, considering you've got about, what did you say, $78 million in deferred maintenance costs. Have you thought about maybe an appropriation bond and then user fees to pay that bond off? Is that a route that you're willing to go down? Could you explain?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we looked at a number of things. Principally, we also try to figure out a way to make sure that the sport remains affordable. And obviously, we've looked at that. There is another bill in the tax committee right now that would capture the funds that we pay for adult hockey and for food and beverage and put them in a fund and use them for deferred maintenance. So we looked at various ways where there'd be an ongoing source of revenue to adjust that. We haven't looked specifically at our own bond. We would welcome any possibility to figure out a way to have a consistent source of funds to continue to replace this, to repair and replace this facility. The second piece in our request, though, that would affect some of you, more of you who still have ice rinks that have an R22 issue is funding the Mighty Ducks program. I believe the governor puts about $900,000 in this request. as soon as we get those funds, they'll probably be out the door. As you know, if you happen to have one of those ICE facilities in your district, we're all kind of queuing up trying to figure out how we're going to take care of this R22 problem. R22 really is Freon. If you think about what Freon was in the old days in cars, they kept it for an industrial purpose over 20 years as they phased it out, but now you can no longer buy it. With the 8.5 recommendation to the National Sports Center, that's roughly a third of what we really need, we would probably be looking at simply just replacing that refrigerant and that compressor system within the ice rink and not doing any of the other repairs. But believe me, we will take whatever we can get and make it work, but we realize there's a bigger issue for the sports facility moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And it's for whoever can answer. I represent Plymouth, and you're probably familiar with the Plymouth Ice Center. It is a premier facility that has been constantly updated and expanded. In fact, I'm looking for bonding money to make a fourth rink on it. So if you can help with that, that'd be wonderful. But aside from that, so we transitioned several years ago to out of R22. And it's worked well as far as I know, but you haven't done that yet, right? Why is that?
Who would like to take that one?
Madam Chair, Representative, we haven't done it because we simply don't have the money to do it.
Okay.
I'll refer to Neil, but just for the R22 alone, it's close to.
Madam Chair, members, that dollar amount for us is about a $7 million changeout just for the R22 to go to ammonia.
Madam Chair,
Representative Carroll.
Right. For all eight. Correct. Rinks, yeah. For eight rinks.
Okay. Yeah, you have a lot of rinks. And another one. So part of that was, as I recall, that when we did the changeover, we also reduced the size of the ice from a professional to an Olympic, I believe.
The
other way around. Okay. Whatever the smaller amount is, because that's what people are using now. Is yours, what size are your sheets?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're exactly right. Given the wonderful worldwide hockey that's going on right now, it's a little sacrilege to say, but Herb Brooks was the person who really wanted us all moving to NHL-sized rinks. Olympic-sized rinks. So when the first four rinks were built, those are Olympic-sized sheets. They would be reduced as well because that NHL-sized rinks is what everyone is playing on now. So it does make it a little more efficient because there's less ice surface. You know, we actually have a little bit of a debate, elbows out, sort of who's got the bigger rink, us or a place in Massachusetts, because they have eight sheets as well. We say we have more surface area because we have four Olympic-sized rinks and they don't. But you're absolutely right. That is the trend, and that's where everyone's going towards the NHL-sized rinks.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Carroll.
So if you did that, that would reduce costs, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touched on this, but on the second to last page, you've got a breakout of the cost estimates. And I was looking at that. Of course, it's mapping to the 23.5 for asset preservation. Rather than the 8.6, but could you break out how you would use the 8.6 million and if you were to receive the governor's recommendation, how that would map against this, please?
Mr. Johnson or Mr. Ladd.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think 100% of the 8.6 would be in that ice plant replacement and room buildup. It would go to address the R22 issue and redo the piping that's needed. That original piping that was in, if you can imagine, the sand floors in this building, not concrete floors, which most ice arenas are. All of that piping and the R22 changeup would need to go in that category.
Okay. Representative Ryer.
Thank you. And, it's too bad I think about, the kids and the sled hockey as well, and it's, as a hockey mom, it's really inspiring to see what the sport does for kids. Another question I have is actually about, you were going after a federal grant last year, I believe. Is that correct, and what's the status of that?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative, we actually poked around a little bit, asked about some potential for an earmark, and we were not successful in any of the offices for that.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions from the members, I want to thank you for your time and your presentation today. Lots to think about.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Deed. If you want to make your way to the testifying table, state your name for the record and go ahead with your presentation and testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Economic Development and Research at Deed, and here today to talk about the two items in the Governor's capital investment request. The first is the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program. We're requesting $2.7 million. This program started in 2002. It has a statutory reference. We've completed roughly 200 grants all across the state since inception of that program. The second is the Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program. We're requesting $1.8 million. This is a joint effort with MnDOT that started in 2012, also has statutory reference, and we've completed roughly 30, 35 grants across the state since inception. The first program is the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Program that I'll talk about. I'll refer to it as BDPI. These are grants to local units of government outside of the seven-county metro region. We accept these grants on a rolling basis, so as projects come forth, they apply to us, and we get the projects under contract. We may cover 50% of eligible costs of public infrastructure improvements, such as wastewater treatment, utility extensions, road extensions, etc., to basically support development. Cities are eligible for up to $2 million over 2 years in grants. These are for industrial uses generally within these cities. So think manufacturing, distribution, et cetera. A couple of years ago, we changed some provisions of the law, now allowing 15% of the acreage that you're servicing to be used for incidental purposes. So if you think of a industrial park, and in the corner of an industrial park you may have a gas station to serve that industrial park, that's sort of an incidental use. Also at that time, there is now a 10-year provision where unused or undeveloped lots within the industrial park that could not be used by the eligible industries may now be turned into something else with our approval. This program really helps to lower the cost of development for the industrial development that's happening, but also on the city from providing the infrastructure to those projects. In addition to the general obligation bond funding that we get from this program, historically we've also received over the last probably 6 or 8 years a general fund appropriation for this program as well. So a good example of a BDPI project is in Cold Spring. Cold Spring Brewing expanded. They needed two new city-owned water wells that allowed for the expansion of the business to ultimately meet the needs of the business, but the city needed it obviously as well. You can see the jobs that it created and retained in the community, and these projects are generally matched one-to-one or more. And so what that means is if we provide 50%, the city and or the business have to provide the remaining costs of the project. Our current balance is about $5 million. Since July 1st of 2023, we've done 11 grants. And you can see what we received for this biennium, about $14.5 million between the GO bonds and the general fund. We do, as I mentioned, accept applications on a rolling basis, so we maintain a pipeline. We have four or five projects in the pipeline now that in the coming months are probably going to get under contract. We'll see what our balance is as we get closer to the end of the fiscal year. The second program is the Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program, which I'll call TEDI. We are requesting $1.8 million. This program, as I mentioned, is a joint effort with MnDOT. We run an open RFP process one time per year, generally in the fall. This helps with helps communities with the cost of transportation improvements that benefit obviously businesses in their communities and takes into consideration safety and efficiency of traffic flow. Nonetheless, we can provide funding for land acquisition, construction, other infrastructure improvements that are necessary to improve the transportation infrastructure, serving a business park or rerouting essentially around a city. A good example of a project that we've done is in the city of Dayton. This was off of the interchange of I-94. You can see a number of businesses alongside the interstate. We helped facilitate some of the transportation improvements to connect that industrial park essentially to the connecting road that gets onto the interstate, which essentially was a big safety issue in Dayton before this happened. We awarded $1 million for this project. There was obviously a match for the transportation infrastructure, but we look at a lot of the other incidental investment that actually happens as a result of it. And you can see by the number of businesses that have expanded in that area as a result of this, that private investment is quite substantial for the city. Our current balance is basically zero in this program, $60,000 or so. Since July 1st of 23, we did three grants with $1.9 million that we received in GO bonds in this biennium, plus some what we call reverted funds that weren't spent on other projects in prior years. And we have about $4.5 million in the pipeline for projects in three communities that we listed, that are listed on the slide. So with that, happy to answer any questions on either of these programs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. You know, Representative Lee, as we think about our upcoming travels this summer and fall for our bonding tour, perhaps we should put the Cold Spring Brewing on that list. I mean, it sounds very important. One that I think we should really visit as a committee, don't you think?
I agree.
Yeah. Representative Carroll, sign me up. All right, Representative Kosnick.
Well, Madam Chair, I went to school in St. Cloud, and one of my projects...
You can tell.
Very proud to have attended the Harvard of Central Minnesota. One of the projects we did was at Cold Spring Brewery, so... I'll second your motion to go there.
Fantastic.
My question is on the TEDI program. You've got a pipeline of $4.4 million and cities listed on there. Is that a first come first serve, or how does that work? If we put money in the program, or it's already spoken for, give us some insight into that.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, this TEDI is actually run on an RFP basis. So we would publish, we would do a variety of listening events, you know, for communities to get them to understand what the program is and that we have available funding. We would then accept all the applications. So while we know of these three projects, I would expect that they would probably come in the pipeline, but there could be three, four, five others as well.
Representative Kosnick? No? Okay. Any other further? Oh, Representative Breyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kosnick, for teeing up my question, because it's similar. When the RFPs come in, what are the expectations for the funds to be available for project completion? Does their proposal have to include all of the matching funds as they would with any other bonding project? Or do you, would you have the potential parceling it out but having risk that no project would actually be completed? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Breyer, like other general obligation bond programs, we do require that match up front. We do our work on a reimbursement basis. So communities are spending this money and then seeking reimbursement for us. So prior to any contract being executed, MMB obviously approves the match as well, much like every other program that we run using general obligation bond funding.
Yep. Representative Ryer, you're good? Okay. Representative, or Lead Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Commissioner. So I'm going to ask about one of the programs that we don't see on here, the Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, which is a statewide program. And so can you talk a little bit about your budget request? You know, in the initial request, did you have a submission for that to the administration, and why or why not was it, you know, put forward for us to consider? I know that, you know, when we were working with Representative Erdahl, you know, he wanted to make sure that we ensure, you know, fairness across the entire state. And so in the past, we have funded all three programs, but why this year are you only coming for the BDPI program and TEDDY program and not the one that's for all communities across the state?
Thank you, Representative Lee, because you raised a good point. We do like to make sure all the buckets are filled evenly. Mr. McKinnon?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, thank you for that question and the interest, obviously, in that program. Yes, it was tight to get numbers into the bonding bill. This is a program that we've run for a number of years that Representative Lee is referring to, IBDPI. About a month ago, 2 months ago, we just awarded the remaining balance in that fund, where we had $1.3 million. We just did a project in Stuartville, actually. So currently that balance is zero. But what I would tell you is tough decisions had to be made, unfortunately this one didn't make it.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so of the program with the last awards that you guys sent out, how many applications were in for the last round, and can you give us an idea of what was the amount for those? I would imagine that there will be more applications for that last remaining 1.5 than, you know, what we have. And so we really appreciate knowing what is the actual need that we have for projects across the state.
Mr. McKinnon.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, I assume you're referring to IDBPI. There was not a variety of applications for it. We have been we had been sitting on that money for roughly about a year. As you know, we have 4 years to spend this money, so there were no projects that were upcoming. Since that time that we have awarded, yes, we've become aware of a couple potential projects, specifically one in the metro. We'll see what obviously happens, and certainly as the session moves forward, if anything happens to this program from a funding perspective, but nonetheless aware of a couple of projects that are out there, but the timeline of those projects nor the details of them, we don't have that yet.
All right. Any other member questions, comments, concerns? Nothing. Okay. Thank you for presenting today in front of the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, our next meeting is this coming Thursday. Can you believe it's 2 days away already? February 20th. And we're going to have an exciting day again because every day is exciting when we are at Capital Investments. We've got Department of Corrections up as well as the Public Facilities Authority. So if you are thinking about these things in the next 2 days, please come up with some really good questions. And with that, I believe that we can adjourn our meeting.